Last year, Adam and I and a few hundred friends of DeSoto gathered in the Masonic Lodge inside a cemetery in the heart of Hollywood. Were we there to practice some dark rite? Some sinister ritual designed to bring deceased Star Trek actors back to the plane of the living? To bring an unholy horde of undead nerd celebrities to Earth to consume the brains of the living? No, we were just doing our live show of the Share Your Embarrassment Tour. It's our review of Star Trek V, and we filmed it. We just wanted to let you know to get ready for that live stream announcement coming next week. If you're a Max Fun member and you support our shows, you'll get access to discounted tickets from membership at MaximumFun.org. So, good time to make sure those emails are delivering properly to your inbox. Either way, we'll be announcing ticket links soon here and on our mailing list that you can sign up for at podshop.biz. The Share Your Embarrassment Tour is coming to your living room for one last stop, and you're not going to want to miss it.
Here's to the finest crew in Starfleet. Engage.
Captain Jean-Luc Picard of the U.S.
Commander Benjamin Sisko, the Federation Starbase, Deep Space Nine.
Welcome to the Greatest Generation, Deep Space Nine. It's a Star Trek podcast by a couple of guys who are a little bit embarrassed to have a Star Trek podcast. I'm Ben Harrison.
I'm Adam Pranica. I thought you were going to go in another direction with little bit something. We've had a couple of days.
Well, I was going to say that, but then I was like, no, got to stick to the brand. Got to keep hammering that brand.
People love the format. It's the best thing about our show.
It might be the only thing about our show.
Yeah.
Adam, I have a great big Akoli Hau-based tiki drink in front of me.
Look at you. You used the Akoli Hau. Wow.
I made a quadruple.
No shit. Because
I figured I didn't want to have to pop up and mix another drink. This is a cocktail that would probably cost $40 or $50 at a bar and would be illegal to serve because it's got
because
so
it would,
much.
It would come in a bowl with four straws in it and it would be on fire.
Yeah, like the thing about the zombie, which is one of the foundational tiki cocktails, is it's almost always listed on menus as being for two.
Right.
Like it's intended for two people because I think that I don't think this is true everywhere, but I think that in some jurisdictions, there is like an upper limit to the amount of alcohol you can serve legally to one person in one drink. And what I'm saying is that the zombie ain't got shit on the daiquiri I made for myself today.
Wow. Yeah. I mean, that's a barrel drink in the parlance of one of our favorite tiki bars, Smuggler's Cove.
Yeah.
That drink's going to do the job.
Yeah. This Coco No-No is a Coco Yes Yes.
Well, why don't you break it down for me, let's drink about it style, Ben, for the friends of DeSoto at home who maybe want to make such a thing.
This is dead simple. It's just a big version of my classic daiquiri ratio of three parts rum, two parts lime juice, one part syrup. And the only tweaks are that instead of rum, I'm using Akoli Hau, mm-hmm. which is the, I think it's taro root based
right.
spirit from the Hawaiian Islands.
The official spirit of the hit war movie podcast, Friendly Fire.
That's true. And you bought me a bottle of it. I kicked the bottle to make this drink.
What? You're out? Yeah.
I'm out.
Good job by you. I think I still have half a bottle left.
And the other substitution is that it's a passion fruit syrup instead of straight simple syrup.
That Akoli Hau will cold cock you, Ben. That's a spirit you don't see coming, I don't think.
He was hit over the head with a bottle, sir. A bottle of what? Akoli Hau, sir.
I've got the Broads close at hand.
Oh, good move.
I'm partying safe. What about you? You got a tiki beverage there?
I thought a long time about making an Akoli Hau substitution in the double jungle bird that I made.
Ooh.
But in the end, I stuck with the rum because I love a jungle bird so much, I was afraid of fucking it up. But you're saying that like you can swap them and be happy. Like, I wouldn't have been disappointed if I had gone a Coley Howe instead of Jamaican rum.
Different rums are different, and the cocktail I made, I don't know if a Coley Howe would do the same work that a Jamaican rum would do.
Yeah.
I guess is what I'm grasping at, but I think you're fine.
My Jungle Bird is a double, and it went right up to the top of my Picard tiki glass, which I believe were given to us while we were out on tour, maybe two tours ago is how I remember it, but time doesn't exist anymore. Jungle Bird, of course, the double that I made is going to be 3 ounces of rum, 1.5 ounces of Campari, 2 ounces pineapple juice, 1 ounce lime juice, 1 ounce Demerara syrup, which I just made today, not the regular white sugar syrup. We're going dark with the simple syrup. And shake with ice, pour over ice, and there you have it. Oh, I forgot to tell you, a friend of the show, Grant, sent me a surprise gift lately, which I know this has a name, and I'm not remembering it, but it's a bag to smash ice in for cocktails.
Oh, yeah, a Lewis bag.
A Lewis bag. He gave me a Lewis bag and a Lewis hammer.
Nice. Which is That's like, a fun gift.
Which is like a wooden hammer and a burlap-esque sack for smashing ice cubes in. And it's a real delight. So thanks to Grant for that.
Next time we're able to hang out together, you should bring your Lewis bag and hammer, and we can compare bags and hammers. Because I have such a kit as well.
There was no surer bet that I've ever made in my entire life that you not only knew the name of the Lewis bag and hammer, but that you already had one before me.
I'm a specific kind of dork, Adam.
Yeah. Cheers to you, Ben.
Cheers to you, buddy. I want to make this quick because we're already 6 minutes into our Marin, but I had a big mail haul the other day.
Yeah.
It's just 3 boxes, but they're all pretty big. So do you mind if we do a quick hit mailbag?
Especially if they're big, I say.
Okay. You know, I might be moving soon, so I need these boxes.
Yeah.
That's what I'm trying to say.
Valuable boxes.
Captain, I'm sorry to disturb you.
I'm receiving a code 47.
Verify.
It is code 47, sir. Starfleet emergency frequency.
Captain's eyes only.
I'm going to go with this first one, and this one is from Star Trek Store. That's the sender.
You are not joking about the size of that box. It looks like something you got.
It's a big one.
Yeah.
It says 16 by 16 premium gallery wrap on the packing list here.
Okay.
Adam, we have a...
That's great.
An actual, I mean, this is a print, obviously, but a print on canvas of the painting from Star Trek Colin Picard entitled Daughter.
Wow. That looks great.
This is amazing.
And it's got the face and everything.
It's not the unfinished version. There is no note in here. I don't know who sent this to us.
Wow.
But whoever sent us the painting, Daughter, thank you.
The official policy of Greatest Gen is that anything sent without the name of a sender is a threat that we take that way.
We take all threats seriously.
Wow. That's a really classy piece of artwork right there, Ben.
Yeah, that's like... I feel like that one is the kind of down-low Star Trek paraphernalia that you could hang in a house, and if somebody knows, they're going to really appreciate it. But if they don't know, they're not going to be like, what is this Star Trek shit? You know?
That's the best stuff, I think. This is why I've been ringing the bell about, like, the pillowcase or the luggage or whatever.
Totally. All right. Next one comes from Whitney S. in Ellicott City, Maryland. Another pretty big box here. Oh! This. I'm gonna read the letter first. I'm gonna leave you simmering in that.
Oh no. I'm gonna hit the Jungle Bird.
Get it, player.
God, a Jungle Bird is good. This has been a long time.
That's a nice one. Here's a note from Whitney. Dear Ben and Adam, like many people here in this country, I have been stuck at home. I have used this time to clean out my basement clutter. found this old TNG engineering playset. Thought you guys would enjoy this playing and reenacting famous scenes of TNG with your figurines. Have fun. Keep up the podcast. My husband and I enjoy it every week. Wow. What Whitney has enclosed is a in-box collector's edition Star Trek Generations warp core.
Wow, so you know it's the D. Ben, if that thing doesn't have a kind of rotisserie that you can stick Geordi on for rolling under the blast door, then they didn't consult the experts on a toy like this.
I believe that this is what we lovingly refer to as the Shimoda corner, essentially.
Wow, what a great gift. That looks like it's in excellent shape. You know, we've been to plenty of cons before, and the condition of the toys in box, not always great, but that looks glossy and good.
Yeah. It does look good. The tape is all still fresh on it, and I want to open it, but shall I?
Oh yeah, devalue that thing.
I mean, this is part of the brand, right? We don't not devalue things. We devalue things.
I wonder how much assembly is going to be required.
I kind of think a lot.
Oh, wow.
Based on how it's coming out of the box here.
Yeah.
Wow, it is mint condition, man.
Whoa. It looks really cool.
Yeah, there's some assembly required, and assemble I shall. But, boy, thank you, Whitney. This is super cool.
Nice gift, Whitney. Thanks.
All right. Last box. Biggest box. Coming from Jamaica Plain, from B. Altman. It really screws me up when you put your first initial in your last name. I'm trying to do first name, last initial on these things.
Right.
But, now the public knows that the Altmans of Jamaica Plain are friends of DeSoto. Dear Ben and Adam, since I was laid off in April, I've been motivating myself to get up in the morning, or let's be honest, afternoon, by assigning myself craft projects. I have learned it's a thing I can do to focus my energy and just try and stay present. As a result, I've made a number of things I have no use for and keep sending to my friends. Please accept this gift as a thank you for the many hours of entertainment and good fellowship you have provided as we slip further and further into the mirror universe. Right now, it's a pretty dark time, so perhaps I can be forgiven for occasionally self-medicating with booze, childish fantasies, and by retreating from all seriousness with unrestrained idiocy, which is not exactly the tagline for your podcast, but close enough.
Could be.
I don't tend to agree.
Yeah.
I'm more of an old than most of your viewers, so your perspectives and observations are different than mine, different in a way I find utterly charming. I want to say, despite the penis obsession, but you've worn me down to the point where I have actually caught myself laughing out loud at a dick joke.
Gotcha.
I can't remember the episode, but the exchange was something about Odo, and Ben used the phrase Baroque onanism. That is a funny phrase. What else? The through line of generosity and compassion is heartwarming and true to Trek and well reflected in your fans. I don't have a thick skin myself, so I'm all the more impressed by anyone who can weather the internet as more than a passive observer. With that, I've unpacked my dolphin polishing tools and I've made you this jazz horgon. Display it with pride, perhaps at a Boston live show when our regularly scheduled future resumes. Cheers, Barbara in Boston.
Wow. Boston Barbara coming through.
We have a collection of horgons, that many of which come out on the road with us when we tour, and we put on the table to let people know we're cool. This may be a new addition.
The horgon famously is a signal that you are down with Jemma Haron.
Yes.
A dolphin horgon, of course, being the signal that it's okay for dolphins to have sex with you if they choose to.
Adam, this thing is incredible. This is a hand-carved wood horgon wailing on a saxophone.
That is amazing.
And Barbara has polished it and
probably
put a little stain on it. It's really gorgeous.
It looks like it looks so much better than homemade. It looks professional grade.
It's super professional. Like, this is a craft project par excellence. I cannot believe how awesome this is.
Oh my god. Tell me how heavy it is in your hands.
It is, I mean, it's substantial. It's made out of a real piece of wood. You can see, like, the rings in the wood on the base.
Wow.
Like, I'm guessing she had a log as the starting object, and I don't know how you work wood like this.
You turn it, but that's not how, you'd never make a shape like that from turning a log.
Yeah, this is not lathed. This is, I mean, maybe there is some lathing, but I'm in awe.
Barbara, that's one of the coolest things anyone's ever given us, really.
This was like a banner mail call, I have to say. Like, these three items are like three of my favorite things I've ever opened on the show.
Jeez, that's great. Wow.
Thank you to everyone. Thank you to Barbara. Thank you to Whitney. Thank you to Anonymous Painting Sender.
Barbara mentioned the struggle of the times, and she's not alone in that. I'm glad she's finding something funny and silly to do.
Yeah. This is another Star Trek thing that I feel like you could put out, and if somebody knew what it was, they would be like, oh, hell yeah. And if they didn't, they would be like, oh, what a nice, fun, festive wood carving Ben has selected for this room.
My goal out in the distance on the horizon has changed slightly. Whereas before it was go back out on tour with you, have a great time. Now it's that very same thing, except we're bringing that jazz horgon with us.
Absolutely. You've upgraded our future, Barbara.
Wow. Awesome. Thanks to everyone who has sent us a gift over the last few months. You can get that P.O. box by emailing drunkshimoda@gmail.com. And if we, for whatever reason, find that you don't appear crazy through email, we will give you the real P.O. box address.
We've never given out a fake P.O. box address.
No, that's not what we would do.
That's not our bag. Adam, do you want to get into the episode we came to talk about today?
Let's do it, Ben. It is Deep Space Nine, Season 7, Episode 2, Shadows and Symbols.
Do you realize how incredible this is? No, of course you don't.
We are given the benefit of a last time again, Ben, and it made me wonder why a show like Deep Space Nine and Star Trek in general, actually, this is something that they did in the Discovery series. We should get last time every time, right?
Yeah.
Why
well,
not?
I think that this is like evidence of this as a new innovation in television technology almost. Like,
right.
I don't think that was common practice in 1998 that you would just catch everyone up on everything that's going on your show currently. But it's kind of a similar reel to the last time on that we started with episode one. Like, it doesn't add that much information, you know?
But in a time when Deep Space Nine was leaning more and more into serialized storytelling.
Yeah.
I can imagine even way back in, I don't know, like season two Deep Space Nine, if you had never seen the show before, how helpful it might be to see a couple of clips of the characters you're going to meet for the first time doing something previously to make the show make more sense. Like, that seems like a valuable minute that you could use to onboard a new viewer.
I think you're absolutely right. This episode starts with us getting to know Ezri Dax. We are basically picking up right where we left off at the end of the last episode.
Right.
And she's an interesting character. She's kind of, you know, partly the same character that died in the last season.
Great. It'll be just like old times.
But she has new elements to her backstory.
Except different.
And crucially, she was the kind of Trill that does not want or try for a symbiont. She got some Trills work their entire lives for a symbiont. Some have symbionts thrust upon them.
She was coincidentally ankylosaured.
Kind of like Commander Riker.
I don't know. Like, if you're a Trill and you find yourself on the same ship as a disembodied ankylosaur, I might book a different trip. Like, if I'm not ready. In the way that Ezri Dax mentions she's not, or she wasn't.
Right. She seems like pretty overwhelmed by having had it thrust upon her. Like, she didn't undergo training for it, and there are like medical ramifications that she's dealing with. It's a big deal.
There's personality ramifications that she's dealing with and continues to deal with throughout the episode. I really, like, we so rarely get the chance to scrutinize a first impression with a character that we're going to be with for a long time. And I think it's a unique situation to be thrust in for you and me, but also for the characters on the show who are awkwardly trying to figure out how best to interact with a person that they know, but who has changed quite a bit.
I really wondered what Nicole DeBoer's process was for creating this character too, because it seems like you would want some of your research to be like, how did Terry Farrell play the previous character of Dax? And like, how much of that are you going to try and mix into the way you play this new Dax person?
It's so interesting to me that this is a like shaking the foundation style introduction for Ben Sisko.
Yeah.
Occurring at exactly the same time as his foundation has already been shaking. It's been shook by what's happened on Deep Space Nine and the wormhole. But consider that Ben Sisko does not see the arrival of Ezri Dax as a part of his mysterious journey. I thought that was so weird that she exists in her own fenced-in area in his life. Like, what Ben Sisko chooses to view through the lens of being the Sisko is fairly limited, right? Because as soon as she popped through the door at exactly the time when she did, I was like, whoa, this is like kismet. This is prophet kismet.
Right.
But he doesn't see it that way.
Right now, I'm just glad to see you.
He is pretty focused on, I mean, I think part of it is that like when he experiences prophet kismet, he actually has like conversations with the prophets.
Right. Yeah.
So maybe like coincidences or other things
that would
don't
make
feel
him
like
so fucking annoying if every time something happened to him,
he's like, it's an omen.
Yeah.
This is the prophets. I can tell.
That's like what it would be like to live with prophet kismet your whole life.
I love the presumptiveness of Ezri Dax. I mean, part of this is earned through Dax's long history with Sisko, but when three generations of the Sisko family are like, yeah, we're actually out the door, we're going to another planet, so this isn't actually a great time for you to like take your leave of absence and hang out with us, and she's just like, cool, I'll come with.
It really starts and continues a quality about Ezri Dax, which is like a lack of awareness about where she is and isn't welcome in a circumstance.
Yeah.
Like, everyone already has matching robes with the color of their uniform cut through the middle. Like, they're going to have to stop and make another one for her.
Right, yeah. You know, we actually only got so much linen when we went to the fabric store. So, we're going to have to go back, see if they have it in blue.
Right. I thought it was interesting, like, Ezri Dax shows up in uniform and keeps her uniform on, basically. She's not on duty, though, and she calls Captain Sisko Benjamin or Ben throughout the episode.
Yeah.
Kind of a, while we're talking about first impressions, I thought that was an interesting one to make.
Is that just a he's out of uniform thing?
That's interesting. So, like, when your commanding officer is out of uniform, you don't have to address them as their rank?
I don't know. I'm not, like, deep enough in military culture to know the answer to that for real, but like, I don't feel like it's depicted as that in movies and television.
Yeah.
You know? Anyways, this is an A, B, and C story episode, and the B story is the it was set up in the last episode. It's the Rotarans' mission to take out the Dominion shipyards that Worf needs to go on in order to ensure Jadzia's place in Stovokor. And Julian Bashir and Miles O'Brien have already talked their way into this mission, but Quark wants to talk his way into it also, but he crashes this party at the wrong ass moment.
Did I come to bad time?
Like, so much of this episode is about Worf reacts. And I feel like if either of our wives died, and I hope that never happens.
God forbid.
But if like a bunch of random dudes that you didn't expect show up at the funeral and like stick around for the wake and yeah. like a bunch of time after, wouldn't yeah. that raise
hey, Adam,
the wrong
your wife
kind
was
of
a
suspicion?
Real babe, and I'm just real sorry for your loss.
Right. Like the bartender at the spot that you used to go to. Like, really sweet gesture by the bartender, but also kind of creepy.
What the fuck?
A little suspicious.
Yeah, I would have questions, mm-hmm. for sure.
Yeah.
But Quark's timing is such that he winds up inviting himself on the mission right before the cutting open of the palms to demonstrate everyone's lack of fear of death.
Right.
And boy, you know he wishes he had like spent another 15 minutes locking up the bar before he went over to the Rotaran.
Do you think that if you know you could end pain immediately, that you would be more receptive to the idea of the palm of the hand slash as we see it in Star Trek all the time? Like,
boy,
your feelings about it have got to change, right? If you know you could fix it like that.
Right. If it's a temporary condition and you can yeah. point a dermal regenerator at your palm and
yeah.
close it back up.
It's a weird thing to think about.
That sort of makes what the Klingons do to prove how little they fear death seem not that big a deal.
It's true. Yeah.
Kind of undercuts their whole thing.
It cuts the other way, huh? It cuts the back of the palm.
Gul Dukat.
So,
back on the runabout, they're en route to the desert planet.
If there's a bright center to the universe, you're on the planet that it's farthest from.
And Ezri has become space sick.
Oh my, I'd forgotten how much I hate space travel.
She has spewed everywhere, and we visit the runabout in the aftermath, which
yeah.
for an enclosed area and someone to get sick is a really awful thought. But the smooth surface of a runabout control pad is it's like spilling something on one of those electric stoves with the smooth top. You can just wipe yeah. that up, no problem. If this was a yeah. TOS runabout, forget it.
Like, no, yeah.
Those buttons would be fucked.
Well, sir, it's a plumber's nightmare.
That's like spilling a bunch of marinara in your gas range.
Yeah.
You know, yeah. lots of nooks and crannies for that stuff to get. I would probably be chilling in the back of the runabout if somebody had booted all over the controls personally.
Right.
She gets space sick because this new ankylosaur just doesn't agree with her tummy.
How can you be in Starfleet if you get space sick? Like, this is supposed to endear us to her. Like, I can feel the hand of the writer going like, Ezri Dax is cute. You're going to root for her because she's an underdog and kind of a spaz and all of these things. But the reality of her circumstances doesn't quite hold together in a Star Trek universe.
I'm a trained Starfleet officer.
Do you think that they decided to write the inevitable complaint letters into the character of Joe Sisko here?
Yeah.
And that's why he's like, hey, I know you're sick, but I would like somebody to be flying this fucking thing.
Yeah.
So if one of you'd like to get back into the pilot seat.
Yeah, I think that is, those are the words that they put into Joe Sisko's mouth for sure. Starfleet officers who get space sick are the alien trash of the galaxy to Joe Sisko.
I really wonder how you prepare, like, as an actor, how do you prepare for inevitable hate mail? Because I know,
yeah,
I know that they must have known going in that I think 90% of people that watch the show are going to be like, okay, interesting change.
Mm-hmm.
But people have really strong reactions to shows, and I can only imagine the like bags of mail that they got when they recast Dax like this.
Part of the angle I took with friend of the podcast Anson Mount when we got to interview him was like how that cuts both ways. Like fandom can hug you to death or they could hate you to death depending on how they feel.
Yeah.
And it's such an interesting, I've got to believe that when you're standing up on the cliff of your career and you're ready to jump into Star Trek, that a big thing that you consider is how you might be reacted to and if right. you're ready for that kind of reaction.
it's, I mean, like, it's an annuity for an actor.
Yeah.
To have been in Star Trek. Like,
is it worth it?
Yeah. Like, is it worth it? But also, worst case scenario, I can go to conventions 4 or 5 times a year and get paid $15,000 each time.
Yeah.
And have a pretty easy life.
Yeah. So, and Nicole DeBoer has been at conventions that we've been at. Like,
yeah. And gives off like a really like cool and generous energy. Like, I haven't actually interacted with her, but I've like been in a couple of rooms that she was in, and I felt like she was happy to be there and people were happy to see her, you know? Like, I think that while the like backlash strikes me as having been inevitable, I think she won the preponderance of fans over.
That's great. That's how it should be.
And I think her performance is good in this episode. Like, this is kind of our first real episode with her, and I find her a very appealing character.
I'm wondering what we get for the next 24 episodes with her, though, because we're starting off on the foot of awkward.
Hmm. Speaking of awkward, in the office in Ops on Deep Space Nine, Admiral Beltbuckle is like almost groveling to Kira about this Romulans putting missiles. It's kind of the Romulan missile crisis, I guess, that they have going. This moon of Bajor that the Romulans have put missiles on.
Colonel, I would like to help you, but my hands are tied.
Well, luckily, mine aren't.
And Beltbuckle just does not want Kira to take any hostile action toward the Romulans to end this crisis. It's really interesting to see him kind of back on his heel with a character that's like definitely of a lower objective rank than him.
And yet, have you ever respected Admiral Beltbuckle's authority?
If you do that, Colonel, you'll have a fight on your hands.
I don't feel like they set up the character as a hard ass the way that, like, lover or hater, like Admiral Nechayev.
Are those Valerian canopies?
Admiral Nechayev.
Canopies my ass. That's the Ritz cracker and chopped liver.
Was going to get you to snap to attention and like demanded your respect and allegiance in a way that I've never felt from Beltbuckle.
Yeah, he has I feel like this is a really bad episode for him as a character because he really displays almost zero leadership on any of this stuff. And really, I mean, like, this is an episode about Kira winning him over in a battle of ideas. And it literally turns into a game of chicken that that she wins him over in.
But crucially, like, the sort of game of chicken where in the Romulan car, Beltbuckle is riding shotgun. Like, he doesn't have any of the controls. And it's Kira and the Romulan driving separate cars.
Yeah. It is a really amazing inversion for Star Trek to have the Starfleet guy and a Romulan on the view screen on one side and an alien on the view screen on the other side. And we're rooting for the alien.
You know? Yeah.
It really hit me in this episode how far, you know, and in a good way, how far this episode, this series has come from TNG.
Admiral Beltbuckle's reaction to the idea of missiles on this moon are sort of like impotently political in a way that feels very contemporary.
Yeah,
you know,
like, totally.
He's like, "What are you gonna do? We need them for our war.
Yeah,
we can't just tell them no." Here's the thing. The missiles are on the moon, but they don't have the launch sequencers. And these launch sequencers are going to be brought there by a bunch of warbirds. And Kira is proposing/promising a blockade of these ships bringing those launch sequencers, thus making the Romulan missile crisis that you were describing.
Right. On the desert planet where Sisko has brought the crew to look for sand faces, Ezri, Ben, Joe, and for some reason Jake beam down in their linen desert wear and their normcore Balenciaga sneakers. And they begin to trek across the Vasquez Rocks area of California.
There was a time in 1998 where you could not buy a t-shirt without a single horizontal stripe across the front.
Oh yeah, I had all of those t-shirts.
Yeah, this was that time.
Yeah.
This begins the torture of Brock Peters in a way that I just couldn't get with. The episode recognizes the great pain that Joe Sisko goes through, but yeah. I don't know if as a viewer you can separate Joe Sisko from Brock Peters in a walk through the desert situation that we get here.
He looks very hot and very uncomfortable.
I don't think it's cool what they did to him. I love Brock Peters, and there's got to be a better way.
Yeah. I mean, like, it's almost comical at a certain point where he's like so unable to keep up that Jake is like holding him up. Like he's like walking wounded or something.
It's very you and I walking someplace with our wives and then, and they're like in the dust.
'Cause we're nervously fast walking and they're like normal, well-adjusted humans that can take their time and enjoy themselves.
I've got one speed on the walk. It's very hard to adjust that.
Yeah, it's tough.
To be quite honest about it, I was in a pail.
A bucket.
A pail.
Mr. Bucket,
I have to revert back to my living state.
Oh, no, no.
I don't use the bucket anymore.
Not everything is going great on the Rotaran either.
We are going to fly toward the molten heart of the sun. So close that our ship will glow like a flaming comet.
It's a bit of a mixed bag of a crew, and Worf has never had a great deal of respect for Quark. Quark feels very specifically disrespected on this ship.
We're risking our lives to help Jadzia get into Stovacor. The very least Worf could do is show us some appreciation.
Quark is filled with that kind of conflict that's like, on the one hand, he's there to do a solid for a friend slash love interest. On the other hand, almost equally opposing is the idea, the shitty idea that shitty people have about only doing something nice in order to receive the benefit of the appreciation for that nice thing.
Yeah, he does not like that Worf keeps glaring at him. But also, like, I don't think Miles is there because he bore a cross for Jadzia, but Quark and Bashir definitely are.
Right. At any point, Worf could have thrown them off the mission before they left.
Right.
I think it unintentionally speaks to how fucked up Worf is that he didn't.
Yeah.
He's very mission-minded.
What do you think the deal is with Worf switching to Klingon armor for this episode?
I mean, I love the choice visually. It feels correct, but contextually, I think it's a great question. Like, he didn't do the drop his comm badge on Colonel Kira's desk.
Right. I'm going to do some wanton murders, right? That would get me in trouble if I was doing it in my official capacity.
I mean, this is old hat, right? And not only that, like, this does not feel like a mission that has been condoned by Admiral Buckle or anyone else.
No.
Like, this is their own thing.
But we also know that, like, when a Starfleet goes on exchange to the Pach, for example, they keep their Starfleet uniform.
This feels a lot like the Valiant mission. How is this different?
Oh, boy.
I guess Martok has the authority granted to him by the High Council to do a mission like this, but I don't remember it explicitly being given or discussed, right?
Yeah, it seems like, I mean, who knows? Like, does a Klingon house have leave to go pick a battle if they want to go do a battle?
Yeah. Yeah. I don't
know.
Maybe
they do.
Maybe that's part of the treaty.
Yeah. Anyways.
So the mission is to fly the Rotaran close enough to the star next door to the shipyard to create a solar ejection strong enough to destroy the shipyard. That's right. Next to it. That's the idea. This is something that we saw in that two-parter episode in TNG, right? Decent, part one or part two. Like, that happened then, right? That destroyed that Borg ship.
If her calculations are off, that eruption could encompass us.
Well, I'll just have to make sure my calculations are accurate, Lieutenant.
That was Dr. Crusher using that Klingon shield technology to change their shield harmonics so that they could withstand the being inside the corona.
What's great about being on a Klingon ship is you already have the benefit of those shield harmonics.
Yeah.
They're already baked in.
You don't have to pull it up in the computer and sideload it while everybody's white-knuckling it.
Right.
It's great.
If you were wondering what was happening on Cardassia during this time, Damar is participating in Take Your Date to Work Day.
To victory on all fronts.
When Wei-Yun walks in, I feel like the subtext is, Damar, why do you have a civilian in the war room? She could see the big board.
This is like taking a date to Cheyenne Mountain.
Totally, yeah. And being drunk the entire time.
Right. Damar is great. It really tells me how much power Damar has for his ability to do this unchecked.
He's king shit of Cardassia and really only has Wei-Yun to answer to. And Wei-Yun is always temporary, you know? Any given Wei-Yun, anyways.
Wei-Yun is super fun here because the most chill way of saying a thing is also the most threatening. So for Wei-Yun, like the version of if I told you I'd have to kill you is I'll have to have her executed if she sees anything that she shouldn't, which is so much fun.
They are still trying to figure out how to retake the Chintaka system, and they have a brief conversation about stepping up the output of the shipyard that we know the Rotaran to be headed for, bent on its destruction. So this is like a scene that feels like it is just in here to remind everyone who the bad guys are.
Yeah, because we rarely come back to this scene.
And remind everybody that Damar is going a little Kanar crazy.
One thing I didn't need a reminder of was the domestic life of Odo and Kira. Kira leans into Odo and accepts a pretty shitty massage, I feel like, if you are lovers with Odo. Like, anytime he only gives you two hands, I feel like that's not giving you his all.
Oh, yeah. He's not going to get, like, carpal tunnel or anything. He can really Rolf you.
A lover of two pianos.
How many hands would you like this time?
He could just turn into one of those Sharper Image massage chairs.
I know. If I were Kira, I would be pissed because this is like 1% of what he's capable of massage-wise.
He also he's doing that thing where he's got his arm up on the back of the sofa and his hand is kind of hanging off the front of that over her boob. Yeah. And she definitely grabs the hand and kisses it. And I feel like that's, she's doing that as a way of like, don't touch my boob.
One thing I noticed about this scene, Ben, and I don't know if you have the episode up, but at around 19 minutes, I feel like Kira's nose ridge is gone. Did you notice this?
Looking.
It may be because it's underlit, and by that I mean the light source is under her face to take away the shadows. But I was watching this on my regular TV. I didn't see any nose ridges. That just looked like Na Visitor on screen in this scene. And I wondered if that was an error or not.
What I'm seeing is a tiny bit of loaf, and it seems like loaf without ruffles in it.
Careful, they're ruffled.
Yeah.
And yeah, I wonder if that's just the flatness and angle of the light. But
I think when you're working with the loaf, especially the kind that includes ridges, I think you need to be aware of that. Like I know a lot of like shadowing could be added with makeup.
Yeah.
But light is going to be your primary conduit toward that. And it seems like neither happened for this scene. Or at least this close-up, you know?
It's hard to see the ridges in the close-up, but then in the wide, you see them.
That's what's so weird. It felt like a continuity error.
Yeah. Very strange.
Yeah.
Anyways, Odo, hopeless romantic that he is, commits to going on the blockade mission.
So you're saying your ships don't have defensive ability or weapons of any kind? Sounds like fun.
Sign me up for this hopeless suicide mission.
I haven't been killed yet, so maybe I can't be killed. I don't know.
Let's test the hypothesis that I am, in fact, unkillable.
What are you doing now?
Ow! Ow! Ow!
Not be guard.
Exactly.
on planet Tyree, Sisso keeps hearing voices in his head calling for Dr. Wyckoff.
This is a Myrtle Wyckoff Avenue bound L train.
Is this it?
I think so.
This is kind of like the halfway mark on the episode when he starts to get pretty close to what he's looking for, which is the Orb of the Prophet. And I feel like this is when the episode really starts to kind of cross-cut really rapidly between the A, B, and right. C stories.
You and I aren't going to do that conversationally because that's no fun for anyone.
It is not. But what Sisko winds up doing, he's kind of in this canyon and Ezri is like trying to snap him out of it. And he's in this like strange fixated state where he doesn't seem to be aware of the people around him, least of which is his elderly father. And to get his attention, she steals his baseball and flings it off. And he has a flashback to the time his baseball fell off the piano and is now convinced that where the baseball landed is the X marks the spot that he needs to go dig. And I really like this because I like that Ezri is like, I threw it just in a random direction. I didn't throw it specifically.
Ben, maybe my memories are playing tricks on me, but have you gotten stranger?
This is one of those fun sequences where you cut to a medium shot of an actor throwing a ball and then you cut to a wider shot of the ball flying through the air. And it's like it was shot out of a can.
Yeah. Suddenly,
it's great.
Suddenly it's like the center fielder hitting the catcher's mitt from deep in the outfield. And you're like, how did she do that?
This is so hard to do. Like, so I want to be clear. I'm not laughing at the show for not getting this right because no one gets this right. But it's always fun for me.
Yeah. Yeah.
To see how they try to match it up. Ben, this was a moment where, like, as Joe Sisko is falling behind and Ben Sisko is becoming more and more subject to his visions, why didn't the episode try to inject a conflict between those two wherein a choice would have to be made? Like, is Joe Sisko going to live through this? Maybe he won't.
Are you sure you don't want to go back up to the runabout?
We started this together. And we'll finish it together.
Do Ezri and, for some reason, Jake need to pick a side as far as what to choose here? Because that would seem to be an easy and good way to inject even more stress into this moment. And the stress that we feel, quite honestly, is like whether or not Ben Sisko's inclination toward his visions is going to bear any fruit, you know? Like, why not make him choose between his father's life and pursuing this course?
Yeah, I mean, I feel like you could take it that way or just take it the way of, like, why is Brock Peters even in this episode? Because I don't feel like they gave the character anything to do. Like, it's this weird middle thing of he's written into all these scenes and they're like, okay, like let's make him tired, I guess. But it doesn't add to the story. It doesn't raise the stakes or lower the stakes or anything. It's just he is off in the background going through his own thing that has no bearing on the story.
I think you and I have over the years made it clear that we are not exactly Ira Stephen Baer stans. But one of the things I read about this episode was that he sort of laughed at the idea of putting Brock Peters through this. Like, a lot of people thought it was cruel to put Brock Peters through this. Ha ha ha.
Yuck.
Like, whatever, man. Don't be like that.
Yeah. That's weak as fuck.
Didn't like reading that.
For real.
Where the ball lands is where Ben Sisko digs. And digging in sand is hard.
I don't like sand.
Because because sand is dry and shovels are not strong.
And the Sarlacc eats old people's medicine for fuel.
They're everywhere. I don't even know why the scientists make them.
Back at the blockade of Derna, all of the assembled Bajoran ships are there. And one quality of the Bajoran ships is that they don't look threatening in any way.
Yeah.
We know them to not have good defensive or offensive capabilities. And everyone who works on them just seems a little too chill for war.
Yeah, a little like corn-fed and low energy. Like,
yeah,
they're just a bunch of kind of like who gives a shit blonde guys. I feel like.
So Belt Buckle hails Kira, and Belt Buckle is, as we've described before, like sitting shotgun in the chicken car while Senator Kreetak is driving. It's a two shot on the FaceTime, and Belt Buckle hails Kira with her and is like, look, the medical supplies are on their way and they're inside these warbirds. If you attempt to stop these warbirds with your Bajoran ships, it's going to be like a fist through a wet paper bag. Like, really think this through.
It is a little imbalanced from the way the Cuban Missile Crisis worked, where it was a bunch of American warships and like shitty Soviet vessels from before World War II trying to run the blockade.
Right. And because these are the odds, Senator Kreetak believes Kira to be bluffing, and as anyone would.
Right. And you kind of hope in a moment like this that when the FaceTime gets turned off, you'll cut back to Kreetak sitting with Admiral Belt Buckle going like, wow, well, we can't kill all these Bajorans. Like, I really hope they give up, but if they don't, we're going to have to call this off. But she does not say that. She says the opposite.
You still think she's going to back down?
She has to. Because I won't.
There is no mention of the loss of life being the stakes of the thing. And I was pretty surprised by that.
Kreetak's political calculus does not factor in, I don't want to say humanitarian catastrophe.
Right. Why, the very name is racist.
There was I think it was the official Star Trek account had a Twitter poll running the other day, like, or it was like a quiz, like click this quiz and see if you can guess the race of all these Star Trek people. And I was like, maybe use the word species. I feel like race is gross.
Yeah. Yeah. So on the Rotoran, Martok has noticed Worf's attitude towards his friends.
Yeah.
And is like, why are you being mean to your friends? And this gets Worf to apologize.
I feel like Martok and Worf are such good influences on each other, despite so many reasons they shouldn't be. So many times Martok has been up his own ass about what a great fucking general he is, and Worf has had to talk him into like actually taking his crew seriously, or Worf has been jealous of the men who want to fuck his wife, despite the fact that she is dead. And they always talk each other back from the ledge, you know? Like, they're like, we make fun, but they're a good team.
Are we sure that they shot Jadzia's body out in the torpedo?
I mean, we didn't see it, so we can't be totally sure, but
I have been accused of creepy things before. Worf apologizes. Yeah. That's fine. But I feel like a real Klingon apology happens twice, right? You get the primary and the backup, is what I'm saying.
And they're vertically oriented, not side to side.
Maybe my favorite part of this episode is how the shipyard looks.
Yeah.
It looks great.
It looks cool.
I want to see more shipyards in Star Trek, period. We get so few.
Yeah. So their goal is to go kind of like buzz the surface of the sun of this sector and kind of kick up an ejecta wake that is going to take out everything. And so they cloak and just like slink right through the shipyard to do that.
Morn.
Dear sweet.
Morn.
You near, buddy?
Morn.
Stop. Hammer time.
On the surface of Tyree, while Joe Sisko fights dehydration.
Like, at what point does Sisko's family begin resenting him for this is what I was thinking at this point.
Yeah. Because Ezri's like yelling at Ben Sisko, and Jake is like, don't even try talking to him right now. He's totally doing some prophet shit and you're not going to get through. And we finally find out about who Dr. Wyckoff is. Dr. Wyckoff is in the 1950s Benny Russell averse.
Right, where Benny Russell has been put into an asylum. And he is the patient of this man.
We're also proud of you.
I need to go home. I don't belong here.
He is writing on the walls of his cell in this mental institution. And according to Dr. Wyckoff, people who are fine don't write on walls.
Dr. Wyckoff is played by the same actor who plays Damar. And kind of a treat to see him out of the spoon.
Yeah.
Good looking guy.
I liked seeing Casey Biggs playing a normal. Yeah. Not drunk at all.
There's a lot of cross-cutting here in the next couple of minutes because Captain Sisko is in the desert in a trance and we're experiencing this moment with Benny Russell back and forth. So Captain Sisko has unearthed this box with the orb of the emissary in it, and for some reason Jake touches it. We realize that was a bad idea because he is immediately connected to the jerk cable and yeah. pulled away from it at a high rate of speed.
He gets Keiko lightninged across the desert.
Yeah.
And we're kind of cutting to the 1950s reality where Dr. Wyckoff is trying to convince Benny to take a paint roller to his story. This is the story of Deep Space Nine that he's written in pencil on the walls of the cell. And in the context of like a therapeutic intervention, Dr. Wyckoff wants him to paint over it. And it sort of becomes clear.
Now, when your doctor at your asylum hands you a paint roller to paint over your possible fantasy, you're going to want to load up the roll with a good amount of your paint.
We're going to start with a primer layer because these pencil marks are thick. These scrawlings of a madman will surely show through at least two layers of paint. So a good primer base is a great way to start the job off right.
This is a great moment. Like the moment the roller is held up to the wall, you can feel the tension. I wasn't sure if he was going to roll over it or not.
It's a very iconic looking image too. Like it's this like institutional kind of barfy green white wall and the barfy green white paint with the text against it. And it's like his brown skin and the black text and then the white wall as the contrast of that. And those are like the only two colors you see.
The color temperature of inside and outside too is a big contrast.
I really liked it. And
It was well done.
And this goes through several phases. Like there's the part where Ben Sisko is trying to like rebury the orb case and make the bad thing go away. And you start to feel like, are we really in Benny Russell's fantasy? And if Ben Sisko gets rid of the orb case, does that mean the fantasy goes away and dies and the story is over?
It's very never-ending story-esque, and it is consistent with that thing that we learned about there being a moment where Deep Space Nine almost took that right turn into the entire series being a Benny Russell story.
Yeah. We're cross-cutting around like the Romulan ships are nose-to-nose with the Bajoran ships, the Rotoran is trying and not succeeding to trigger the sun when a bunch of ticks discover them and start making chase. And this all comes to a head when Benny Russell throws down the paint roller and like decks Dr. Wyckoff and the orderlies in his room and gets back to writing the story. Like, I guess presumably just everybody is so knocked out in his cell that he has some time to continue writing.
Now, if you happen to spill some paint in your asylum cell, first gather up all of the paint in as many rags as you can use and then use some mineral spirits to clean up the rest. That way, you won't permanently stain the floor.
Now, if you're in a deep desert on an extremely arid planet and you happen to find a case with an orb inside, throw the doors open as wide as they can to let the farts get out and fly up into space. Inevitably, they will degrease the door that opens your wormhole.
This was an amazing moment. The doors fly open. The wormhole opens again. We cut to Deep Space Nine, where they're made aware of this. the sensors pick this up at the blockade.
Yeah. This feels like the moment that you write episode one of season seven around. And
it does. Yeah.
The fact that episode one ends with no promise of this, I feel like is pretty, like, I think I liked that episode less because I was worried about this still. And you have to be like pretty confident in your series' ability to retain viewers to throw a curveball at them like that.
I wonder how emboldened you are in season seven to care or not care about such a thing.
Right.
You know?
Yeah. Do they know at this point that this is the last season of the series?
I think they do.
Yeah. And so are they just not leaving anything for the swim back at this point?
I think they might be subscribing to a philosophy happening on the Rotoran right now, which is they have tried to make this sun ejection happen. It didn't work the first time.
Take me out of the oven, Boogie. Cooked.
And then we rack over to a inspirational painting on the bridge that says, in Klingon, shoot for the sun. Even if you miss, you'll be among very angry Jem'Hadar warships.
And then it pans over and it's a kitten hanging from a branch and it says, hang in there.
Yeah. So they have to whip the Rotoran around because its pants are down all the way. They have no other choice but to go make another pass. And they get this thing to happen. The solar flare consumes the shipyard. It makes a big boom. It's a great success.
They escape, and the pursuing ticks get consumed by the fireball. And so Worf has some free time to dip into a Klingon prayer, which it seems to be about ensuring that Jadzia is admitted to Stovacor on the honor of this act.
You really want to do this? Here, now, okay, let's do it!
Back in the desert, the Sisko has a vision, and it's Sarah. Sarah is there to tell the Sisko that he has been on a predetermined path, and that path has led him to this moment.
This is the prophet that took corporeal form to be a lady to make Ben Sisko. And like what he kind of realizes is that like there was a real woman that the prophet sort of possessed.
There is no Dana. There is only Zoo.
And forced to fall in love with Ben Sisko's dad. And then when the prophet unpossessed that woman, she was like, ugh.
We needed like 10% more Joe Sisko in this episode to reconcile himself to this moment.
What if I told you that the lady that turned out to be my secret mom didn't actually love you and was in fact under the control of an alien being? When you got married, what?
I don't think either of us would advocate for like the tidy ending, the perfect Spielberg ending where no one gets hurt and everyone is happy, and Ben Sisko tells Joe Sisko that he's a good man and a good father.
Yeah, and then it crossfades to a waving United Federation of Planets flag.
Here's the thing. The episode makes it easy to forget that Sarah Sisko was a real person with agency, because all you ever know of Sarah Sisko from the episode's perspective is the version of her that was taken over by the prophet. And that's the version that Joe Sisko is telling us about. The version that is without the possession, we never know anything about aside from her death.
This is an episode that does not know that women are not sand faces.
It's so bizarre. Like,
there's like a charitable read of this that it's like one of those things, like, you know, like when somebody goes off birth control or a psychiatric medication and it changes the way their relationship dynamics work. Mm-hmm. And like being unpossessed by a prophet maybe had that effect on Sarah Sisko. Like, she was into it for real, but then wasn't. But like,
I think you have to be specific to what degree Sarah Sisko was into it. And this episode does not make that clear. And that's what's a little pervy.
And what's going on here seems pretty pervy, doesn't it?
There's something dark and fucked up there, for sure.
And it's so easy to unfuck it up, too, I think.
Yeah.
And that's what sucks about that realization is that they really pay it very little lip service.
It's weird. It's like, I mean, like, I would say that the as close as they get to paying it lip service is that Joe Sisko doesn't want to talk about it, which makes me think it's the worst thing.
Yeah, that's a great call. And I think it's a little convenient that non-possessed Sarah dies and we never get her take on things.
Yeah.
It's a little skeevy that it's a reverse. It's Bechamel test is what it is. It's men talking about Sarah Sisko.
Yeah. Did you just come up with Bechamel test?
That has to have been a thing already.
Wow.
When it's dudes getting together to just talk about a girl, that's got to be what it is, right?
If you coined that, that is fucking brilliant.
I'm going to Google it right now. I'm positive it already exists. There's no way that I'm seeing it in a comic book.
Okay.
Anyway, would have been nice, but it's not me.
Yeah. I mean, I think, honestly, rewrite it to make Joe Sisko happier about like having had a nice affair with this lady.
Uh-huh.
And maybe it doesn't feel as weird.
Maybe we need another episode here that fills this story out where we get to know Sarah Sisko a little better. Because this is insufficient.
Indeed. So Ben Sisko slams the doors shut on the box and it's like, okay, cool. Well, I have a new rededication to my position as the emissary of the prophets because the prophets, in fact, made sure I existed.
Please disperse. Nothing to see here.
I feel like a number of storylines sort of wheeze their way to a conclusion here at the same time because back at the blockade, Senator Kretak stands down because something changed.
You can blink now, Colonel.
What changed besides time is my question. This seems like an unmotivated stand down by Kretak.
What Admiral Beltbuckle says is that he wound up being the motivator. He said, well, if you shoot up these Bajorans, then Starfleet is going to make it a problem for you. But like it's such a disservice to his character not to show that moment.
Yeah.
Like a major amount of character change took place off camera. And we watch TV shows to see characters change. Show us that.
It's true. It's true. And if the earlier moment wasn't the scene you write your episode around, the button is.
Yeah.
The Sisko returns to Deep Space Nine, having completed his mission in the desert. He picks up a random kid and takes him with him.
Yeah. This is my child now, he says, and walks off.
But that isn't the moment that is the most shocking to the rest of the crew. It's that Ezri Dax has also come home in her own way. And timpani sounds the crew that she used to know as she does.
And her previous host's widowed husband.
Right.
Like a, hey, let's catch up sometime. Anyways, gotta go.
If the next episode isn't specifically about Worf and Ezri Dax figuring out whether or not they're married, then I don't even know what the show's been about up until now. Did you like the episode though, Ben?
I think on balance, I did like the episode. There's definitely some weird choices that we talked about, but I thought that it did a pretty good job of, like, I think it's an interesting episode to put all of the conclusions of threads that you've been weaving for several episodes, not right at the end of the last season and not right at the beginning of this season, but one further episode into this season. Like, that's a very, like, weird and interesting choice. And I like that they kind of went weird with it. So, you know, it's like there are some missteps, but overall, I think the weirdness is really appealing to me.
It is extremely weird. I think my main takeaway from the episode is that Ben Sisko is half God. And what my theory presupposes is Joe Sisko fucked a god.
We don't get to see him process that.
No, we don't. And here's Here's a sad piece of recognition, Ben. This is the last Joe Sisko episode we get in Deep Space Nine. And I think that is criminal.
That sucks.
How you send this character out by making him suffer in the desert, and then you don't give him at least that moment where he goes back to Sisko's restaurant.
Boy, yeah. I mean, there's the long stare in the mirror, haunted version of that, or just the getting back to work. But it would have been nice to have something to send this character out on.
Yeah.
I am finishing my drink right now, by the way.
Yeah, I'm done. One thing that's always on the menu about this time is the reading of a Priority One message or two. You want to go see what we got over there?
Okay.
Priority One message from Starfleet coming in on secured channel.
Need a supplemental income.
Supplemental income?
Supplemental.
Supplemental.
Yeah, it's extra.
But the interest alone could be enough to buy this ship.
Adam, we have a couple of Priority One messages here. The first one is from the drunk Borg guy from Cleveland. And it's to Ben and Adam. And it goes like this. I owe you two an apology. When you came to Cleveland back in 2017, I was the guy dressed as the Borg at the show. The evening as a whole is a bit fuzzy, but my wife and I had a blast. It was great meeting you two and Card Daddy Bill Tilly. That was the night that we met Card Daddy Bill Tilly.
It was. Wow, that was a big night for us.
I think about the moment I had to run downstairs for something, and you were at the merch table, and when I ran back upstairs, Bill Tilly was in the bar, and I was like, I know I've got to hurry to get back to Adam because he's at the merch table by himself, and I don't want to leave him hanging there, but there was Bill Tilly.
Yeah.
I had to go in for the daps. Anyways, I will continue Drunk Board Guy's message. Sorry for being a literal drunk Shimoda. I owe the three of you a round of hooves. All the best. Ah, Drunk Board Guy. Don't sweat it.
Yeah, I don't think Drunk Board Guy needs to worry at all. The enduring memory from the Cleveland show, if it's not meeting Bill Tilly for the first time, it's the shame of the only backstage bathroom being on the other side of the stage and me having to take a panic shit 5 minutes before the show started by crossing the lit stage to do that.
Yeah.
I'm gone for an amount of time that is only known as the amount of time to take a shit. The sound of a flushing toilet and then me crossing the stage again in the light.
I don't know why that venue puts a mic right by the toilet so that they can amplify the flush.
Yeah. It was messed up. It was like something out of a Naked Gun movie. I didn't appreciate it. So Drunk Board Guy from Cleveland, you're in the clear as far as I'm concerned.
Adam accrued all the shame around himself that night.
Ben, our second Priority One message is to all LGBT Trek fans everywhere. It's from Joey, and the message goes like this. Liking Star Trek is gay culture, but we're happy to share it with Ben, Adam, and the friends of DeSoto. Anyway, here's the Chris Brenner drop.
I'm Chris Brenner. Brenner Information Systems. You know, interface, operations, net access, channel 90.
That Chris Brenner.
That's dope. Hell yeah, Joey.
Hey, thanks for sharing, Joey. If you didn't, we wouldn't have a show here.
Yeah, we would be podcasting about like Sequest or something, probably.
I don't think Sequest has the staying power for a popular podcast. But yeah. If you're out there making a Sequest podcast, I tip my hat to you. Well, if you have a Priority One message, you can take it on over to MaximumFun.org/Jumbotron, where personal messages are $100 and commercial messages are $200, both of which go a long way in supporting the mission of the Greatest Generation.
Gotta get that gold press light.
Hey, Adam.
What's that, Ben?
Did you find yourself a drunk Shimoda?
Drunk Shimoda!
You know, sometimes the drunk Shimoda goes to, like, the silly or the weird or the thing that doesn't fit. I feel like my Shimoda is a dark Shimoda.
Oh, shit.
Because I'm going to read this from the note that I found. In defending the decision to send 72-year-old Joseph Sisko actor Brock Peters into the Palmdale Desert for the scenes on Tyree, Ira Stephen Bear explained that Ben came back home to be with his father, and I just felt that keeping the family together meant something. If it had been my kid, I'd have gone with my kid. If it had been Bonanza, Ben Cartwright would have gone with Little Joe and Haas. So, like, a nice Bonanza reference there as a defense for his decision to send 72-year-old Joseph Sisko out into the scorching desert. A decision that I cannot agree with.
Not that cool. My drunk Shimoda, I'll brighten the mood a little bit, is just Quark for picking the moment to come into the Klingon ceremony of what? Oh, what are we doing? Cutting ourselves open? Well, I guess I have to also.
God, he could have timed that better.
Sure could have. So he is my drunk Shimoda. All right, Adam, time to talk about what next week looks like for us. I'm going to fire up the Game of Buttholes, the Will of the Prophets, which is at gach.biz/game. Of course, we are currently on the 46th square on the board. That's the Coco No-No square. And out ahead, we've got a space butthole, and I think that's the only thing mathematically that we can hit.
Ben, we always play this game on the up and up.
Yeah.
We've never been untrue with what we've rolled or what we've gotten. I want to give you a premonition.
Okay.
I really think we're going to hit that fucking space butthole again and go back down. I've got a dark, bad feeling.
Wow.
About this next roll. I hope I have a better feeling about the episode to go with it. What's it going to be about?
If we hit that butthole, it's a fuck it, we'll do it live episode, which I know you really don't want to be on. So
no, I don't want that.
Here we go. The next episode is season 7, episode 3, After Image. Ezri Dax's arrival unleashes conflicting emotions in everyone who knew Jadzia, particularly in Worf.
There you go. I wanted this episode. Maybe that's where my premonition was more accurately placed. Maybe it had nothing to do with the Game of Buttholes, the Will of the Prophets.
Yeah, let's hope.
You're required to learn as you play. Roll.
Okay, Adam, I've got the die in my hands, and I'm going to roll it. Here we go.
Chula!
Did I win?
Hardly.
Oh, boy. Big roll. I hit the 6. We are currently on square 52. Regular episode with a Quark's bar and a looking at each other during out ahead.
All right.
Don't know what that... I mean, like, the looking at each other during would have to be done outside in a socially distanced format, right?
Yeah, that would be how it would have to go. A lot of environmental sounds would be happening on an episode like that. I'm not sure if the people would like it.
Didn't we record an episode in a hot tub one time?
We recorded an episode in a hot tub, but not a hot tub.
Oh, right. Maybe it was an episode of Let's Drink About It that we recorded outside one time.
That sounds like something you crazy kids would have done.
Yeah.
With that hit show that is sorely missed even today.
I know it's sorely missed. We'll figure it out.
Yeah, it's just too bad no one wants to drink and talk about what's fucked up in their lives. Like that seems like a show without an audience, Ben. It's crazy.
Anyways,
I say that with love. I say this with love, Ben. The people who make the show possible are those that go to maximumfun.org/join.
Yeah.
They keep the show going with their monthly financial contributions, and they're the only reason the show exists.
Boy, that is the triple truth, and we really appreciate it. We also appreciate folks that go to Apple Podcasts or whatever app they use to get podcasts and leave a nice rating and review, or recommend the show to a friend or on their social media or whatever. That really helps us grow and find new friends of DeSoto. There's people out there walking around right now that are not yet friends of DeSoto, but will be. They just don't know it yet. We need your help to find them.
And they'd be great friends of DeSoto. They're pre-friends of DeSoto, yeah, is what they are.
Love those people.
It's too bad.
Let's get them in here. Let's get them under this big tent.
You could open their eyes.
Yeah.
If only they knew.
Say, listen, I'm going to do you a favor. I'm going to put you onto a podcast. It's called The Greatest Generation.
A non-confrontational way to do that might be over social media. People talk about the show on Twitter using the hashtag GreatestGen. They follow our official Twitter feed run by the card daddy Bill Tilly.
Yep.
It's a Greatest Trek.
Also an Instagram account that you can follow. Greatest Trek.
Right. So many ways to stay in touch. Talk about the show. Lots of people over on Facebook in our myriad groups over there.
Sure.
Though I would recommend to all of those people there, I'm hoping that they're working on the construction of other places to go that are not on Facebook.
Yeah. Maybe make a forum on a server that you control so that you're not feeding the beast that is the Facebook.
Here's a promise that I'll put out there right now. If you are a Facebook group related to The Greatest Generation and you make a thing outside Facebook and leave Facebook, I will plug that on the show.
Yeah, for sure. We have one last thanks before we go to give to our dear, dear buddy, Adam Ragusea. He is now a YouTube sensation. Go search Adam Ragusea on YouTube. He's going to teach you how to cook. Love his channel. I am a weekly viewer of it.
So am I. He's one of the most generous friends of DeSoto. He's made a bunch of the music on the show. He also supported us a lot through Max Fun Drive 2020. So thanks to the Goose. And with that, we'll be back at you next time with another great episode of Star Trek Deep Space Nine and an episode of The Greatest Generation Deep Space Nine, which is getting all sorts of weird looks.
On the desert planet. What was it called again? Tatooine?
Yeah.
Jakku?
I'd have to look it up.
MaximumFun.org.
Comedy and culture.
Artist owned.
Audience supported.